The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Thank you very much, Bill, for that wonderful introduction. I don't know who you were talking about, but good to be here anyway and to be part of this tremendous conference, which I believe is handling the issues that we all need to be together corporately handling. And I'm glad that we have all of these perspectives. What I've heard already last night and this morning has given me an insight into the amount of thinking that is going on in this direction. And it thrills my heart to know that we are engaging in widening some of our perspectives, sometimes which were too narrow, far too restricted, and to begin to see the need for a holistic perspective. My own pilgrimage into this engagement in environmental sort of affairs all over the world, particularly in India, started really way back. You know, I was a student of chemical engineering. I liked a few things that I studied, but the rest of it was far too restricted. I was constantly looking for something more holistic. So I left my chemical engineering. I said I didn't need this kind of education. I went into music. I even covered Duke Ellington's visit to India as a journalist, so Bill would be delighted to hear that. And went into music, and as a musician, thinking that was all I was looking for, finally discovering all of the hidden facts about a musician, and as a young, budding, ambitious musician, going into all of those and discovering that's not what I needed. Till I met the Lord Jesus Christ, and as a 25-year-old, to discover an experience with Jesus Christ, a beautiful, transforming experience, which gave me a kind, set me on a pilgrimage where I began to look at things a little more holistically, I must say, there were still Western perspectives which are being laid on me, which were far too restricted. And I was trying to break out of them and look at all of the Bible. Let me clarify and qualify myself as a Bible-loving evangelical. So I was constantly delving deeper into the Bible to get this holistic perspective that I needed to be engaged in. One day, I read this book by Francis Schaeffer that was once again referred to last night, Pollution and the Death of Man. Was written way ahead of its time, I believe, particularly for the evangelicals. I looked at that because within that were references to the hippies whom I knew and the kind of philosophies that they followed and that I had met up with them and discussed some of those issues. And then reading that scathing article, that lecture by Lynn White Jr., that was one of the most, you know, alarming facts that set me on thinking in the direction of what we need to be doing as Bible-believing Christians. In the 80s, I was in India, back in India after my studies in England. And during my studies, right during the time of this very, very, you know, heavily and exciting academic engagement with all of the German theology and philosophies and everything, enjoying anything from Hegel to Tillich and, you know, everybody that I could put my hands on, suddenly one day reading the book of Acts and getting so excited about practical, down-to-earth Christianity. And God just took those words, silver and gold have I none, such as I have give I thee. That was a translation I was reading at that time. In the name of Jesus, rise up and walk. Those words, rise up and walk, just pierced me. And I went into just contemplating, meditating on what God was saying, and God gave me this whole vision, this holistic vision of the ACTS Institute. Today, ACTS, A-C-T-S, stands for Agriculture, Crafts, Trades, and Studies. And not particularly in that order or anything referring particularly to those items, but referring mainly to a very holistic kind of a Bible training. So I went back, climbed down from all of that academic high that I was, and went down to grassroots level interactions with believers, along with believers, serving the poor, serving the needy. This great big, you know, upsurge, you hear about the Dalits today, with millions being ready for, you know, conversion. I have worked with them for 20 years, and I have not been interested in the millions coming. I have just looked at the individuals, the families that have come and have been transformed. And we have over 1,500 of these converts praising the Lord, recognizing the living God with whom they have fellowship now. So ACTS has really been engaged right within this holistic kind of enterprise, right, you know, from my time in mission. I remember starting off with the community health programs that we were dealing with in India. And this is where you begin to see some of the perspective that has driven me into looking more holistically at being engaged in the mission that God has given us. The community health programs, of course, we had already made a step away from mainly curative kind of approaches. And we were beginning to think of health education and cleaning up the surroundings within which they lived and their homes and things, the poor, the suffering, the downtrodden. Gradually, even from that time, I began challenging the medical doctors. I said, unless and until we begin to handle some of the environmental linkages with the diseases and the problems that these people are facing, we will not have addressed the issue of disease, of sickness, and all that they are facing. There are wider issues apart from what you see, a dirty gutter around with filthy water, mosquitoes hanging around those. I said there are even wider implications that we need to be looking at. And constantly looking for this holism that, you know, we need to be discovering. In the early 80s, I began writing a book, putting together lectures, which I was delivering already at the MTH level in various seminaries in India. There was a dynamism about that. Something is happening over there. We're heading towards something. Now, is there a developing world perspective? This is very important for us to look at. Is there a developing world perspective? The church, for many, you know, centuries, Christians, missionaries told us, no, there is only one perspective. You know, you've got to look at it this way, particularly when idealism and the kind of theories of, you know, classical cultures and all were being peddled around. There was just one kind of a perspective that was being peddled all over. But I do believe that there is a developing world perspective, and you need to be grasping a little bit more about what it is. There are religious and cultural traditions, very beautiful religious and cultural traditions that we need to be looking at. You know, sometimes we looked at these religious traditions and we wrote them off as being, you know, animistic, heathen, pagan. But gradually, even Christians are beginning to look at some of these cultural and religious traditions which had very, very sound factual evidence behind them for whatever they were supposed to be doing. The medicinal plants, for instance, Ayurveda, the kind of Eastern medical approaches. Today, even Christians who one time thought they were of the demon, beginning to look at it. And these were kinds of environmental thinking that came in very much. Religious and cultural traditions from the that protected the environment, the Chipko movement, which I may talk about, in very briefly. These became social movements, really. There were social movements when their forests were being depleted, when the commercial West was coming and exploiting their poverty, and a middleman really, the exploiter many times is not only the rich capitalist in the West, it's a middleman over there, right within our context, who is taking advantage of the two sides and making a lot of money. The Chipko movement, Chipko basically meaning to hug, to hang on to stick to. And there was this group of women, a whole social movement, women who went and hugged these trees and did not allow the axe to fall on the groves that they were protecting. There were, and there are still, the kind of sacred groves that are being protected and propagated even more now. And these people, of course, for them it was far more than a sacred grove. It was their very livelihood. They depended on those forests around them. So there were social movements that have come about because of perspectives that these people have. There are accusations from within the West. It is not just Western accusations, from within the West, that we have not looked very much at these perspectives. We've not looked at the understanding and the teachings of people outside of the rich West. And we looked at some of them yesterday, Lynn White Jr. we considered. There were many others who have attacked the fact of the Western anthropocentricity and all of these things that we will look at. These accusations need to be handled. And these accusations have helped us in reviving some of these perspectives. And I believe very much that this developing world perspective is very much a biblical perspective. One of the most exciting things that happened to me was the first time I went to Israel. Suddenly the Bible comes alive. The Bible comes alive. But even before that, there were a number of things in the Bible I understood that my Western friends did not understand, because there's a beautiful perspective there, which is our perspective, which you have taken from us and made it so complicated and given to it all kinds of dimensions that we don't understand anymore. There is a perspective, the biblical perspective, that we need to be respecting, which is really our perspective. And so there is that perspective. One of the things that we need to be looking at before we look at anything from a third world perspective is that we are handling basically varying attitudes to the environmental sort of movement and the environmental issues. I must, admit that I confess that I do know that many of us, many of you in the West, are hesitating to get anywhere near the, into environmental sort of engagement, because there is this constant kind of fear of what the environmentalists did, all of the different kinds of movements. But that is not what we need to be afraid of at all. Why allow people? I remember talking to one of my Japanese professor friends. We were having a long ride, a three-hour ride in this bullet train from Osaka to Tokyo. And we were beginning to talk about curriculum that is very, very peculiar to our, distinctive to the third world, that we need to be developing. And I mentioned we need to have environmental studies as one very, very important area within our theological schools. The man looked at me, he was shocked. He says, "Now, Dr. Ken, I want to tell you that I am, hesitating very much, because there's a New Age movement that is looking at all of our philosophies. There is all this environmentalism that is confusing people." I allowed him to go through all of it, and I said, those are the very reasons for which I want us to be studying about the environmental movement and what we Christians need to be doing. Very reasons. We need to be taking away that confusion. And there are these confusions, there are these attitudes, and basically, you know, environmental sort of environmentalists will look at, you know, from these three different attitudes, there's the anthropocentric attitude. There's the anthropocentric attitude. The ecofeminists would like to make it even an androcentric attitude, purely the human being, the man-centered attitude. But this anthropocentric attitude that, you know, was attacked by, you know, was exposed and attacked, Len White Jr. and others who brought this, you know, into our consideration, and we began to look at how much we need to be going wider. Basically, I think the anthropocentric attitude being attacked in the Bible wasn't just requiring biblical skills to exegete the Bible in a new way. It was talking about whatever that teaching did to bring about capitalism and the free enterprise and market-oriented sort of wealth production and all of that. And those were the things that these environmentalists were attacking. And as they attacked those, they attacked it purely from that anthropocentric, individualistic Western perspective. So there is something correct in what they say. There is something correct in what they say. What is wrong in what they say is that the Eastern religions had it right. And what has been offered as an alternative is the biocentric attitude. Now, biocentrism, as the word sort of refers to, talks about everything having equal value, everything being equal. They attack the Hebrew biblical perspective, a kind of a hierarchical perspective, God, man, woman, then creation, and even in the creation order, all of these various, the hierarchy. They attacked that, and they were talking about everything being equal. So deep ecologists, for instance, they consider us being very shallow, so they want to take things deep. And they go into kinds of treatments which are more biocentric, and they claim these are what Eastern religions, these are what the animistic religions and the others were propagating, and something that we need to be looking at. The biocentrism by itself, I think, is not the answer. Even a Hindu or a Buddhist is not completely biocentric. Human sin prevails all over. And you and I who believe in this, you know, have to consider that, you know, the human being, no matter what attitude prevails, he goes above that or under that or around that and develops his own individual perspective. There's greed and there's arrogance in every religion. So biocentrism by itself is not the answer. We look at, you know, from our perspective, what we see, what we look at as theocentrism. And this is a beautiful, beautiful attitude, and one of the, you know, there's so many beautiful references to it. Paul, for instance, by him, in him, through him, we have our being. You know, it's the kind of Eastern perspective, that is, where everything, God is in me, he's around me, he's, you know, he is overwhelming. And this theocentric perspective really is a biblical perspective and would be more the third world, the Eastern perspective as we look at. Because, and when we consider environmental issues, this is what we need to be looking at very carefully. So I make as my contribution to this conference, as my contribution, you know, to people, you know, thinking, five propositions basically. These are propositions that are based on ecological, environmental kind of engagement that we need to be having. It is based on biblical and missiological perspectives. The first one of these, proposition number one, is that ecological issues are global, and hence all local issues must be considered in the global context. Therefore, you know, we can't just say this is a third world perspective, this is a Western perspective, this is the poorer perspective, this is the northern perspective. Perspectives, all of these come together into one holism, into one holistic perspective because of the global interconnectedness. In fact, the whole environmental movement is something where there is this interconnectedness so beautifully coming out in the scientific studies, really. That's where it started off. So the chains, the cycles, the flows, whether it is energy or matter, all of these talking about a beautiful interrelatedness and interconnectedness. Therefore, when we talk about the environmental movement, what's happening in the richer part of the globe impacts the poorer sections. What is happening in the poorer sections impacts the global, the entire global scenario. And so we've got to be looking at poverty and development. For instance, when we talk about this interrelatedness, there is a tremendous linkage, you know, that many times we didn't see. Even we in India looked at poverty and we only addressed it saying, yes, they are lazy. And the Hindu would say, yes, that is karma, that is fate, and that's all there is to that. But we began to see poverty, ecology, development, all of these interlinked so beautifully, not beautifully, but very closely. There is a close connection between poverty and environmental degradation. The cause as well as the effect. Very, very integrally sort of linked up. Many of the poor, they've had to plunder and loot their environment because of their poverty. And once they've degraded that environment, that continues to influence and affect their environment. There's a growing disparity between the rich North and the poor South. You know, many times you've heard this many times, so maybe your conscience is deadened to statements like, you are rich because we are poor. Or at least we are poor because you are rich.
This is the end of side one. Please flip the tape at this point.
You know, the colonial kind conquests were not just spreading Western culture and spreading development ideologies. They were basically out there looting, plundering, and therefore in many parts of the colonies, there is still this kind of an attitude where, you know, the ecological debt and all of that is being talked about centuries of plundering that went on that have caused the poverty in some of these countries. Now, I must say, there is a disparity between the rich and the exploited poor, even within the developing world. This interconnectedness is what I'm talking about. So no issue is to be looked at in isolation. Constantly discover what the whole is. In fact, part of my thesis in London University was, you know, looking at meaning of the parts within the whole. And that gave me, you know, terrific drive in order to get engaged in this holism, the disparity between the rich and the exploited poor. Moving on, there are some very familiar examples which I'll briefly go through, you know, meat from Central America in order to make your hamburgers cheaper. There was Coca-Cola and Pepsi, you know, bottling in our poorer countries because environmental laws can be flouted very, very easily. And the middleman only needs some money in order to, you know, go past those. And the gas tragedy in Bhopal, the Union Carbide set up its plant once again, the kind of consequences which I've seen a few years ago continuing in the population around that Bhopal, the Union Carbide place over there. Proposition number two, stewardship in the developing world must consider its own agenda and not that of the developed world. You know, many times we environmentalists or we evangelists or we missiologists like to repeat what we've heard in the West and go and impress our people within our countries that, you know, we know all that these problems are. But many of these problems are peculiar. There is a global linkage. There's a global interconnectedness that I've pointed out. But there is this local distinctive that we have got to consider. The African agenda, you know, one of the writers bringing out beautifully, the African Green Movement cannot afford to ignore the mundane issues of development. And what are they? How to save a tree? How to cut it? That is our question. So we're not talking immediately about global warming and, you know, the ozone layer depletion, etc. We're talking about down-to-earth, ground-level realities. And there are some beautiful, you know, examples, powerful examples, people like Wangari Maathai, a woman who just got involved in this movement, raised up grassroots-level communities, and millions of trees being planted using traditional methods, not the chemicals, the fertilizers and all of that, and bringing about even replenishment of the soil. So those are the kind of things. Schumacher, you know, brought out something very familiar, you know, give a man a fish and you feed him for today, teach him how to fish. Now, the way he develops this is beautiful. Give a man a fish, you're helping him for a short while. Teach him the art of fishing and he can help himself all his life. Yes, we know that. Now he goes on a little higher. Supply him with a fishing tackle, all of the Western paraphernalia around those beautiful fishing rods that you're familiar with. Say you're an ecologist going out to fish. And provide him with all of that. And that's going to be a little costly effort. The result is doubtless. He's going to be coming back to you. I need a fresh tackle. I need more line. I need more of this. So the replacements are going to be a constant drain on you. He's dependent on you. Teach him how to make his own fishing tackle. And you've helped him to become not only self-supporting, but also self-reliant and independent. The kind of thing where, you know, Schumacher, of course, talks about appropriate technologies. You know, he goes to the extent that, you know, many of the modern kind of technological revolutions too would be questioned by him and by Mahatma Gandhi and others. But I think we've got to be a little more realistic, but the principles that are brought out here are excellent. One of the efforts we were engaged in, and a number of these in India, where we empower women to get into their situations, develop water holdings, tanks, ponds, which they can, with their own natural kind of plant vegetation, vegetative check dams and all of that, give them little principles in watershed management. They get in, they do it, and these two women and several others like that, so proud that at the end of a year and a half, they were able to develop their own water reservoir, and they own it. They collect money from people who come and use it. They maintain it. And that is the kind of thing appropriately that we need to be looking at from those perspectives. Now, what are some of key factors? I believe, once again, religious foundations, when we talk about these kind of local implications. Socio-cultural foundations are very, very important. In other words, these two will give us the idea of that particular worldview. And many times, Western environmentalists have come to us with their Western worldview and tried to transform our thinking without addressing that worldview, which is basic to a number of the problems that are there. The economic context in which these people are, the local global impacts are very, very important as we address these local issues I'm talking about, the economic context. How can we drive them? Where do we need to take them? How soon can we time them into progressing where we want them to? The local global impact and, of course, the ecological context of that particular area. Proposition number 3. Environmental stewardship in the developing world must place greater emphasis on minimizing and utilizing waste. You live in a waste culture here. I've seen far more waste these 4 weeks than I've seen food in many homes in India. You know, it is shocking. It is shocking. I don't go by all of those statistics that people bring before you to, you know, arouse your consciences, but I think it is shocking. And the more I look at it, the more I'm concerned that my people, where I am, people in Africa, in Asia, need to be looking at how they can minimize the use of resources and waste minimization is there, as well as utilizing waste. I work with a group of Swiss ecologists. They call themselves eco-engineers, ecological engineers. And they have transferred to us some tremendous technologies on how waste can even generate wealth. Waste can be used very, very productively to not only bring about, you know, side effects that benefit society. So in the area of garbage, in the area of water management, there's also money that can come out in utilizing wealth, in waste. You know, we see tremendous things like this. This is a scene in the Philippines. When one of my ecological friends looked at this, he says, "Ken, that's like a bowl of soup to me. I'd like to see how I can transform that into wealth for the community. Make it truly, because there are so many nutrients in that which we can bring out and use for the community." We ourselves on our ACTS Institute campus, a very, very, you know, innovative kind of a campus, we have begun to, you know, this was a dry, arid bit of land which we gradually reclaimed our campuses there. All of our wastewater, you know, once again, those nutrients, why do we want to throw away, discard, waste, or dump into a freshwater pond that is near, which farmers are using? And we have used all of that waste and very natural treatments, reed grass, lotus, and water hyacinth, which is in abundance. And then you get plenty of water afterwards, not potable, not drinking water, but terrific water for the plants. And we've had some beautiful vegetables growing on our campus. Proposition number 4. Environmental stewardship in the developing world must grasp the significance of sustainability in managing its own resources. Sustainability, managing of resources. ACTS Institute, the group that I'm, you know, talk about this holistic mission, from our waste, we've generated terrific resources. There are vegetables that the agricultural university has tested, no problem with them. The elite in the community want to get at these. They're willing to pay any price for fresh vegetable from Adam's garden. And it's been terrific the way we've been able to impact the community, take garbage from them, compost that, put it into the garden, and bring out these vegetables, take it back, full cycle to them, show them this terrific interrelatedness that ecological issues, you know, refer to. What is sustainability? A beautiful term that came out in the Rio summit powerfully. Sustainability was defined sustainable development. Development that meets the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. Beautiful, you know, powerful definition, because it not only takes up the sustainability within our generation, but is talking about sustainability for the future generations as well. Just a few days ago, I was talking to a friend of mine, a typical American Christian. And he says, "Ken, why are you wasting your time in all of this environmental work? You know, the Lord's coming back any time, and the Lord is going to restore all of this." He had young children. I pointed to those young children and said, "What about those? You think the Lord, if the Lord does not come during your lifetime, aren't you concerned about those little ones growing up? He was speechless. He was speechless. Suddenly the truth comes home to you when it meets you where you are. Till then, it's all a theory that you're trying to grapple with, but it doesn't make sense. What about future generations? And sustainability has to do a lot with that kind of a thing. Asia's rich biodiversity is being exploited. And praise God, some governments, very corrupt governments, but they're giving priority to protecting, propagating endangered flora and fauna. Medicinal plants and properties being documented. This is a rich, rich contribution that, you know, Asia can make to the rest of the world. And already, I think there are the kind of property rights and the copyright, the patenting problems that are coming out. And we have accepted this challenge, and we're going into production of medicinal plants through some of the environmental action projects we're involved in, including the biodegradation and the composting of feces in order to replenish, rejuvenate lands and to make them more productive. And finally, my fifth proposition. Christians in the developing world must demonstrate themselves to be true models of stewardship within their own context. We've got to develop this kind of a stewardship model. I love the stewardship model. You know, John Douglas Hall's name was mentioned yesterday, and we, you know, must ask ourselves and look at it, the question, why should we be stewards? The steward is a particularly apt metaphor for humanity because it encapsulates the two sides of human relatedness, the relation to God on the one hand and to non-human creatures on the other. The human being is, as God's steward, accountable to God and responsible for its fellow creatures. And this, once again, is a beautiful Asian kind of an approach where, you know, relationship to God, relationship to human beings around. And I'm not saying we need to be accepting Asian religions, but I'm looking at, you know, developing kind of commonalities where we could together in these countries make an impact. And we as Christians, missionaries, evangelists, pastors, being stewards of God's creation and God's stewards in the world today. Therefore, I believe we need to be exalting God as creator and redeemer. The only way we can handle this whole, you know, emphasis on creation spirituality and creator theologies is by looking at God as redeemer as well. For me, my own, you know, transformation came when I shifted from Genesis 3 to Genesis 1 in writing theology. There was a beautiful engagement in this holism. So, but the balance needs to come as we exalt God as creator and redeemer. The stewards call for responsible care of creation. Responsibility is a key word in stewardship. Show responsibility towards others as well, towards other human beings, towards future generations, all of these coming in powerfully. Build an interreligious community. And to some of you, it may be shocking, you know, why do we need to build an interreligious community? I believe in the world that we live in, and you've been shocked into this after 9/11, you know, we need to be building bridges a lot more and not isolating ourselves. The power of the gospel would flow through far more effectively when we get involved, integrated into the creation community that God has placed us in. And once we build this interfaith community, I believe some common engagements like this could become much more effective. And finally, what this is doing is helping us to fulfill God's total mission for his world, for his creation, for the entire universe that he has placed us as part of. Praise God.